So welcome to the 17th Conversation on Buddha Nature. I'm Marcus Perman, Executive Director of Sadhu Foundation. Conversations on Buddha Nature is a series of online interviews with Buddhist practitioners, scholars, and thinkers on the topic of Buddha Nature, hosted by Sadhu Foundation in association with the educational resource website, buddhanature.org. For this event, our regular host, Lopan Dr. Karma Punso, will speak with John Canty, a Buddhist practitioner, translator, physician, and the current editorial director of 84,000, Translating the Words of the Buddha. You can watch all the past events on the buddhanature.org resource website, and they're now available as both video and audio recordings that you can download and play anytime. Please feel free to send questions with the Q&A function on Zoom, or if you're on Facebook, use the comment section. You can do that during the discussion, and we'll have some time set aside for questions with the speakers at the end. So we're honored to have John with us here today. It's always a joy to see you. John studied medicine and anthropology at Cambridge University and qualified as a doctor in 1975. While still a medical student, he met and began to study with some of the great Tibetan Buddhist masters of the older generation, especially Kangyu Rinpoche, Dudrum Rinpoche, and Dogo Khyentse Rinpoche. After some years of medical work in northeastern Nepal in the late 1970s, he went to Dordogne, France to complete 2 3-year retreats at Chanteloube and has remained primarily based there ever since. John is a founding member of the Padmakara Translation Group and was a Sadhu Foundation Fellow from 2001 to 2014 and was awarded the 2016 Khyentse Foundation Fellowship. In 2009, when 84,000 first started, he was appointed editorial chair, and in 2020, he became editorial co-director. So as you all know, Lopan Dr. Karma Punso is the recipient of Sadhu Foundation's Writer in Digital Residence Grant for Buddha Nature Studies and is our host for these conversations on Buddha Nature. Karma Punso is one of Bhutan's leading intellectuals and completed both monastic training in the Tibetan traditions, as well as a doctorate at Oxford. He is the founder of the Lodin Foundation in Bhutan, and his work is well known across the Himalayas and in Buddhist study circles around the world. So without further ado, please welcome John Canty joining us from France and Karma Punso joining us from Bhutan. Thank you.
Thank you, Marcus. And welcome everyone. Welcome, John. Nice to meet you virtually. It's wonderful to have you for our conversations this time. You gave this title, describing yourself as a dilettante, but when I think of you, you are a very experienced Buddhist master translator. You encountered Buddhism as early as 1969 and been engaged in study, practice, and translation works. So that's as much as I have been alive. So there is probably a great deal of wisdom and experience that I and many others can gain from you. So it's a great honor to have you this year. But before we start the session, why don't we give a few moments to be here and now, to be mindful of where we are and our state of mind, and cultivate the altruistic intention that this session and whatever we do in our life be beneficial to both oneself and others and lead all sentient beings to the state of enlightenment. Thank you. So John, as you know, we have had this forum for now a year and a half. And the main sort of aspiration we have is really to spread this news of Buddha nature or the innate goodness of all beings, particularly human beings. So to sort of make people aware of this concept called Buddha nature, and then where there are people who are already familiar with this topic, to sort of deepen our understanding a bit by discussing both theories and practices related to Buddha nature. And so great to have you, as I said earlier. Before we listen to you on Buddha nature specifically, we would like to know how you encountered Buddhism or the teachings on Buddha nature, what brought you to be who you are right now, and what kind of work you are doing currently. You're muted, I think, John.
Oh, thank you. Yes, so sorry. Yes, thank you for your introduction, which makes me feel very ancient and old. But
enlightened.
I don't know about that. Time flies so fast, doesn't it? That's mainly what's happened to me. But it's interesting. I've actually followed many of the conversations that you've been having in this series with great interest and admiration. And, I think it's very nice to have this mixture of people from the academic world and practitioners, and many people, of course, who are both. And I suppose that's my case, in more sort of academic contexts, I always sort of feel a bit of an imposter, because I'm lucky enough, I can sort of call myself doctor, which is funny, because when I was in medicine, PhDs from the humanities and other subjects, we sort of thought of as kind of fake doctors, who weren't the real thing. And now it's the reverse situation. I'm the fake, I'm a sort of imposter in this world, but people don't realize it because they might have seen my title, as if I had a PhD, which of course I don't. I'm a sort of bridge in a way between the two worlds. And I suppose part of the problem with being in a little bit in both worlds is that you perhaps not fully, I won't say fulfilled, because I do feel very interested in both sides of the story. But it would be wonderful to be an incredible dedicated practitioner. Although if I was one, you probably wouldn't be seeing me here today. And it would be very interesting too to be fully trained in all of the skills and disciplines necessary to have a really full understanding of this incredible world of the texts and the literature of the Dharma, which is so extraordinary. So I'm a sort of hybrid. And it happened, as you said, I met, when I first went up to Cambridge to study medicine, it was more or less within a few days that I started making contact with people who were interested in Buddhism. One of my very first contacts, interestingly, was Diana Pybus, who later became Trungpa Rinpoche's wife, who was really my first contact. I met her, she was sitting in the corridor of my college in Cambridge waiting for my neighbor to come back, who I'd only just briefly met, but who became a lifelong friend and is still here in Dordogne with us. Several of us from that period stayed together for quite a long time and formed the core group of Padmakara, but I'm getting too far ahead now. Yes, it was very interesting in Cambridge as a student, because we had a lot of people coming through giving talks to something called the Cambridge University Buddhist Society, and we had exposure to a wonderful array of, Sinhalese monks and Thai laymen and Japanese Zen monks and Tibetans and Koreans and all kinds of people, and including a strange bunch of British ex-colonials, who were sort of interested in astral travel and that kind of thing. And the famous Christmas Humphreys, who was a high court judge who founded the London Buddhist Society, all of these people would come and give talks. And so it was a very nice introduction to the range of Buddhists and so forth. But I kept a sort of parallel interest my studies were going on, and at the same time, I was absorbing quite a lot of Buddhist culture and interest, and trying to practice a little bit in various ways. And within a few years, I was really lucky enough to come across, you know, some of the great masters of the old generation. And I count myself extremely lucky, but, you know, it's difficult to be fully aware of what extraordinary people they were nowadays. That was an amazing generation of people who'd done all of their training in Tibet and had really, really extremely fully accomplished people. Like I'm talking about Dzogchen Rinpoche, Daegu Kenshi Rinpoche, Kanji Rinpoche. And it seems extraordinary to have had the chance to meet them and to study with them a little bit and to practice under their guidance. Mm-hmm. And so that really set me off, I suppose. And it's been a lifelong exploration. I don't think, I think a lifetime is hardly enough. Mm. You know what I mean? We've got a long way to go, especially we Westerners who are brought up in a very, very different culture and a very different tradition. We start off with all sorts of fantasies and romantic notions and gradually learn how to actually apply that to who we really are and how our minds really work and all the rest of it. But I think it would be fair to say that what really struck me in the beginning was two things. Coming across, well, really all Buddhist practitioners, but some in particular. First of all, it was the extremely pragmatic side of Buddhist practice. You know, you actually have something to do. You don't have to sort of believe something. Mm. You don't have to kind of adopt a faith that you don't particularly really have innately. You start at point A, you know, so you start thinking about this, you're told what to think about and, what the problem is, and to think about suffering, what's wrong, you know, reflect on your life and what brought you there. And there's, you know, some meditation practices which are relatively simple, you know, watching the breath and being mindful of the body and all of these kind of things, which are extremely, you know, it's like a recipe. It's like cooking. You learn to peel the potato and boil the water and put in the salt and, you know what I mean? So there was this, it was a very refreshing side of having something really practical to do. And then I suppose the second thing that was really striking was the quality of the human beings. You know, when you met these great masters, it was just immediately obvious that they were something quite extraordinary, something very different from sort of celebrities that we might be exposed to in Western culture, you know, great politicians or thinkers or something. Quite a different quality, and you don't quite know what it is, but you know that it's something, you know that it's remarkable. And so I suppose those have been the two kind of main guiding things that set me off on my path.
Well, how wonderful. Well, I think you have the best of both worlds, not only of the Dharma Center and the academic world, but also of the scientific secular world and also the spiritual Buddhist world. When you use the word imposter, I can't actually resist sharing this. Now, as a young boy, I used to actually aspire to be a medical doctor, but I never made it. I became a monk instead, and of course ended up in Cambridge after you, talking at the Cambridge Buddhist Society many times. But these days, when I travel across Bhutan sometimes, they would have heard that Dr. Karma is in the village or so, and the next morning I would see a line of sick people. So I almost appear like an imposter, although I don't do that kind of promotion myself. Yeah. But I think you're far from an imposter. So you have done a lot of work, especially leading Padmakara Translation Group, and I've been a user of your wonderful works. Currently, you're also leading 84,000, an amazing project. But then more specifically, you have also been working on this classical text, now the sort of main work on Buddha nature known in the Indo-Tibetan Buddhist world, the Uttara Tantra or Ratnagotra Vibhaga, the ultimate continuum. And you have been translating Mipham's commentary on that, Mipham, the 19th century Tibetan scholar, for the audience who don't know about Mipham. So I want to ask you, what transpired or what inspired rather you to work on the ultimate continuum and Mipham's commentary?
Yes, well, I'm trying to think how it all began. It was a very, very long time ago, unfortunately, that I was really steeped in this text. But part of it is because Pema Wangyal Rinpoche, who is one of Khandzu Rinpoche's sons, who is still with us here in the Dordogne and has guided many of us, was very insistent that Mipham's commentaries in particular were going to be really useful to translate and were very accessible to people in the modern age. And he has also had a particular wish to see Mipham's commentaries of, in particular, of Asanga's works translated, and, you know, the five works of Maitreya, the five works whose authorship is attributed to Maitreya. And so quite a long time ago now, gosh, I can't remember which year it was, we had a wonderful teaching here in the Dordogne from Dzongsa Khyentse Rinpoche about on the Uttara Tantra Shastra. It was actually 2 years running. But Rinpoche was teaching more from, gosh, which commentary was it? It was one of the Sakya commentaries. And so it was a little bit different. He did talk about Mipham's commentary, but it was then that, you know, we sort of started trying to decide, you know, who's going to do which of the translators was going to try and do which text. And in the end, it fell to me to take on Mipham's commentary of the Uttara Tantra. And I'm actually the slowest. I was working on this for some years, and then in 2009 got caught up in this 84,000 project. And I was working, in fact, on the text for the Sadra Foundation, and I feel terribly guilty because I never finished it and had the book published. It's been almost ready for some years, but I still have to finish the writing a proper introduction and doing some final touching up, and I keep being about to get to it and not quite finishing. But anyway, it's kind of a something that I keep in the background for all the rest of my work. And so, yes, I think it's quite an interesting commentary. It's actually very simple compared to some. It doesn't go into a huge range of different, you know, viewpoints on the text, but and it's relatively short, and I think it will be very useful. And I'm, you know, I don't want to let it wait too much longer before we actually manage to publish it.
Wonderful. Well, I'll come back to that commentary later if we have time. But
yes,
to take advantage of having a master translator with us here. And especially somebody who is trying to convey these foreign Buddhist ideas to a wider Western audience. Now, among academics, I'm familiar with academic work, and we often use technical terms to convey these ideas, or we use original terms in Sanskrit or Tibetan. So there's not as much challenge because the audience is almost always familiar with the idea. But then when you're doing translation for the general public, now, especially with that big linguistic and cultural gap between the East and the West, as you mentioned earlier, and to make such ideas accessible, I'm curious to know how you translate terms like Tathagata Garba or Gotra, terms that refer to Buddha nature, dhatu, tathata, and so forth. So can you share a bit about the challenges you face and your preferences of translating these terms?
Yes, well, they are indeed a challenge. And it is, you know, we're always stuck between the idea that, you know, the Sanskrit or Tibetan term has so many connotations and such an atmosphere behind it and such a history behind it. It seems a shame in a way to try to attach some English word which may have very different set of associations for many people to a term, you know. So the temptation is always to leave it in Sanskrit, usually, because that would be the sort of most universal. But of course, if you leave too many words in Sanskrit, you begin to end up with a translation which is not really a translation at all. So it's exactly. Very difficult choice to make. I think there are certainly some words that are almost untranslatable. So for Tathagata Gaba, for example, well, first of all, Tathagata is so difficult, isn't it? struggled with this a bit in the 84,000 work. You know, we have very often ended up translating it as something rather unsatisfactory, like thus gone. And then, of course, that misses out the idea that it can also mean, you know, thus come, or come from suchness and not gone to suchness. Similarly for Sugata, you know, well come or well gone, which one is it, you know, and what does what does well mean? What does suchness mean? So in fact, in my draft translation as it is so far, I've only half translated the words, and I've used, again, for Garba, I tended to translate it as essence, which is not very satisfactory. So I ended up saying something like, you know, Tathagata essence or Sugata essence. And it's very interesting in these texts, you know, why do commentators or even the root texts sometimes say Tathagata Gaba? Why do they sometimes say Sugata Gaba? Why do they sometimes say Kam or Datu? Why do they sometimes talk about Gotra? And I think all of these words, which are essentially synonymous, it would be a great shame to translate them all as Buddha nature, because we would lose the specificity. And I think too, the range of different meanings is really important. So, as I said, I only half translate Tathagata Gaba and Sugata Gaba, but come, I tend to translate as something like a constituent. It's very interesting, isn't it, that Dhatu in Sanskrit has these two renderings in Tibetan. You have Kam and you have Ying. So Chirki Ying as the Dharma Dhatu, but otherwise, you know, Dhatu often translates as Kam, some sort of element or constituent or something that is part of the constitution of something. And I think that is essentially the when kam is used in the Tibetan texts, that's essentially what it's talking about. Sugata Gaba and Tathagata Gaba, you know, there's a lot of discussion in the literature about Gaba meaning an embryo or matrix or whatever it might be, but I think it's kind of simpler to stick to the Tibetan Nyingbo and think about it as being the sort of heart or essence of the Tathagata or the Sugata nature. And then the most difficult is perhaps Gotra, which I think has a very significant meaning. You know, of course, Gotra in Sanskrit, Indian culture, there's this whole very important idea of lineage and clan, and what makes you what you are being to do with your ancestry. And but also, it's not quite, you know, there's this whole thing about Buddha nature. Is it something that we have in us? Or is it, you know, the danger is thinking of it as a thing. Is it a thing? Is it a nature? Or is it something to do with our origins or our destination? You know what I mean? And that's what's really interesting about that, even the title of the Ratnagotra Vibhaga, that it's the Uttara Tantra part, that it's a kind of continuity, and it represents something coming from a source and going to a destiny. And I think that that's where the Gotra business fits in, you know, in the Indian idea of belonging to a clan. And I think, you know, of course, Tibetan, we translate Rik, can translate so many different words in Sanskrit, meaning caste or family or whatever. But this is not Kula, it's not Varna, it's not some of those other words. It's actually Gotra, which is different. Some people translate it as potential, but I think that is... That's okay for some interpretations, but it's a little bit weak, isn't it? If it just means, you know, we can, we will, or can one day become enlightened, then it's not really saying much. It's not much of a, it's not much of a Buddha nature. But I've actually tried to sort of think. I invented, well, not invented, but resurrected an archaic English word, which is geniture, which isn't really used anymore, but most people sort of understand vaguely what it means, because it's related to all of these words like gene and you know, so forth. But it really has been used in past centuries to mean, on the one hand, one's ancestry, one's parents, one's grandparents, etc., and also who one's descendants are, you know, who one's children are. So it's that kind of idea of the continuity over the generations of something. And that seems to
be... You
said
geniture is the term.
Geniture, yes. But it's one of those words, you know, when you're a translator, you get these, after thinking for ages and weeks and months about a particular term, you come up with some idea that you think is brilliant, but nobody else ever will. You know, nobody will ever adopt it. And you feel very enthusiastic about it for a while, and you see how people's faces are very flat when you explain it to them, and you know that it's you know, it's just not going to work. So I don't know what I'll end up using, but disposition is another word. Sorry to interrupt you.
No, not at all. Sorry to interrupt you. So no. I've also been doing some translation, but I would truly consider myself an imposter translator, because a true translator is someone who translates into one's own native language, and you are the one who does that. And I think sometimes we don't get all the connotations an English word can have. So, for instance, if we did use word like potential for Gotra or Rik, it's already giving a specific connotation that will probably restrict the understanding of a full-blown Buddha in us. No?
Yes,
just shows the potential. Yeah, I think in our project, you know, at least the Chadra project on Buddha nature, we are perhaps oversimplifying the complex topic of Tathagata Garbha, but we have been consistently using the English term Buddha nature because it's very easy to convey the sort of general understanding, and I think it it must have originated from the Chinese term forging and rendered into Tibetan sometimes as Sangigi Rangshin. It's much easier to even translate compared to Tathagata Garbha or Gotra or Dhatu. Even Gotra, I actually want to ask you, one of the things that I have been doing, at least the term that I've been using, was gene, and then putting an adjective before that as spiritual gene. And your geniture, I was actually quite comforted to hear that. I wanted to ask you if it's totally off the point that Gotra should refer to call it a spiritual gene, because especially with our modern audience, even here in Bhutan, people can easily sort of strike a chord and understand the term gene as something that is like your Gotra, your Rik. So instead of making sure that it's spiritual, not a physical clan or family line.
I quite like I quite like spiritual gene, and I've heard it used. The problem for me, perhaps I'm being a little bit too hair-splitting, is that a gene in physiology is only a tiny component of what makes us what we are. You know, you need thousands, possibly hundreds of thousands of genes to produce a sort of complete being. So it's a bit too small, you know, whereas Gotra somehow means, you know, almost the whole person, the whole character of the person that's kind of carried by that thing, you know, by that heritage is another sort of word that's almost used, but heritage only goes backwards into the past, if you see what I mean. It's not really something that can carry into the future, which of course is another essential part of what the word means. So I think gene is on the right track. One would almost say, you know, but again, it would be anachronistically scientific. One could almost say, you know, DNA as a whole would be sort of spiritual DNA would be a good metaphor, but it's not really a translation, is it? That's the problem.
And some people also use the term disposition. What's your take on that?
Well, I think it has good qualities. You know, it's on the right track. But again, it's just a little bit too weak. You know, you just have a disposition, you just have an inclination, you just have a sort of a tendency towards, you know, and that, I think that's the trouble with those terms like disposition and potential. They're great, but not, it, perhaps for some interpretations. I would think that, you know, for example, Mipham says it at one point, a sentence which I can't quote it, unfortunately, in Tibetan right now, but something like, you know, if one thinks that, I think he's actually criticizing some past scholars for thinking that Gotra only means the potential to attain Buddhahood. And if that's all that it means, then they're missing the point, sort of thing. So if you translate it as potential, then you say, you know, if you say that the potential only means the potential, you're missing the point. And of course, that doesn't really work. So I think, you know, but again, it depends on the interpretation. And I think on some perhaps Gelugpa and Sakyapa interpretations of the Gyulama, it works perfectly well.
Indeed, I think they have more sort of stress on the potential side as a seed rather than as a full-blown Buddhahood that's latent in you. So, you have also been working on other works, other treatises by Maitreya and Mipham's commentaries. So when you look at the Uttara Tantra, the ultimate continuum, in the context of the overall works of Maitreya, what is your take on the position of Uttara Tantra in relation to other works of Maitreya and also, of course, other sutras and tantras? One of the things we have discussed in the past sessions is also the term Tantra itself in the name of Uttara Tantra, although it's not considered as an esoteric Vajrayana text. So you can share some light on that.
Well, yes, Mipham makes some quite interesting comments on that in his analysis of the title by saying that, you know, the Tantra basically means the kind of continuity or the thread that's running through. But he also makes a sort of reference to the fact that it is like a Tantra in the textual sense. In I can't remember exactly what he says, but he's talking about, you know, the three aspects of the, you know, the ground and the path and the and the fruit, and you know, some of the sort of concepts that are particularly characteristic of tantras as a genre. So he certainly makes that connection as a you know, as a possibility, but you know, we'll never really know, of course, what what the original intention was, but there's a lot to say just about the title itself and the whole idea of, you know, what is meant by Lama as well, you know, by Uttara. Is it
indeed.
Is it something that just comes later? Is it something that is somehow sort of sublime and above everything else? There's, you know, there's a lot to tease out in even in the title. But to go back to what you're asking about the sort of connection between the five texts of Maitreya, I think very interesting, and I wanted to talk a little bit about the authorship as well, because that's something that has fascinated me. But in terms of the connection between the three, of course, the you know, the traditional Tibetan view on it, at least for some scholars, is that the five texts are indeed connected. And I believe that it's said that the Abhisamayalankara, the Nguntokgyen, has a introduction, has a lingchi.
Yes,
and
trije.
Yes, and yes. Then the Gyulama has a colophon, so and the other three don't. And the theory is that, you know, in a sense, Asanga received first the Abhisamayalankara and then the Dodegyen, the Mahayana Sutralankara, and then the two Vibhangas, I can't remember in which order, and then the Gyulama as a kind of set, and that the whole intention of the five texts together was in some sense an explanation of what is meant by the Prajnaparamita teachings. And I find that an extremely interesting idea. And of course, that ties back to the whole legend of the story of how Asanga received them from Maitreya. But it's a Tibetan view, really, isn't it? And if you go to the Chinese scholars and what they believe about the origins of these texts, you get a completely different picture. And they don't believe that the Uttara Tantra was even written by Asanga at all. And they have a completely different, you know, history of its authorship. So I think it's very interesting to take the five texts together, despite their rather mysterious interconnections, you know, over history, because we have this fascinating thing that the Dhamma Dhamma Dhatu Vibhanga and the Uttara Tantra were apparently lost or apparently disappeared for quite a few centuries in India, although we know that they existed in earlier times because of the Chinese translation. And then, of course, the two texts were sort of rediscovered, apparently, according to the traditional account, by Maitripa. And you know, does that indicate that somehow they weren't really of the same authorship, and this is some kind of a later concoction that the Tibetans made? I don't believe that, but that's what some people say. You know, I tend to, it's funny, isn't it? This is a little bit the same with people's allegiances to a particular Tibetan lineage. And it's the same really across the wider picture, whether you brought up as a in the Chinese Buddhist tradition or the Theravada tradition or the Tibetan tradition, you tend to stick with what you started with, isn't it? And you have a strong disinclination to change streams. And I find it funny that really that many of us, you know, we started off studying as the Gelugpa tradition or the Sakyapa tradition or the Nyingma tradition or the Kagyupa tradition, it's kind of that's what you stick to. You know, there aren't many people who change over because they're convinced by the arguments of one of the other lineages. And yet somehow, you know, we of course all feel that the lineage we are studying with must somehow be, at least for us, must be the best, you know. Otherwise, we wouldn't be doing it, would we? But you know, at the same time, other people are equally convinced that what they're studying and what they receive and how they see things is the best. And so I find that fascinating, because are we, you know, what takes preponderance? Are we rational beings who take things entirely on the validity of the arguments? Or are we more convinced by the people we meet and the impact they have on us and the allegiance we feel to, you know, to individual teachers or fellow practitioners or whatever it might be? Do you see what I mean? And I would say that the latter probably colors our views more than we imagine in some, you know, in some way.
I think that's a very precious insight and wisdom from you, because I think that is one of the main weaknesses of people who are following spiritual traditions, particularly spiritual traditions, because probably secular people are more open-minded, although they can be very fanatical about secularism. Indeed, yes. But even within the Tibetan tradition, though, I want to throw this to you and get your take on it. So when you look at the structure, it is quite convincing to think that these five works actually are parts of one sort of single work, because you have one work with the beginning, the supplication and so forth, and then one work, the Uttara Tantra, with the dedication and colophons, and the others don't have either of these and fit in the middle. But then you have also Tibetan scholars, including Mipham himself, arguing that these different texts actually talk about different points belonging to different schools of thought in Mahayana Buddhism. So they couldn't possibly be coherently put as one single work, unless that single work is presenting a diversity of philosophical thought. So some texts considered to be citta matra or mind only in terms of philosophical position. I mean, even to take, for instance, the first text, the Ornament of Realization, which is talking more about the perfection of wisdom and emptiness, and the last text that we are talking about, counter-arguing that and saying there is a true real thing called Buddha nature. So even Tibetans don't necessarily always agree that they are all composed by one person as a single unit, I think. What's your take on that?
Well, I think, you know, one has to be quite broad-minded, and those classifications of texts like these to a particular drupta, you know, point of view, if they were really sort of indisputable, then there wouldn't be arguments about it. But I don't think it's as easy as that. You know, one can point to certain factors in each of the texts that might position them, you know, in one or the other school. But I don't think it's, you know, it's interesting, but I don't think it's ultimately convincing. And to be honest, you know, there's this whole very, very interesting idea. Of course, Mipham ends up saying that he thinks that the correct view is that both the second and third turning teachings are definitive. So in one way, the arguments of the Prajnaparamita about emptiness and the arguments of the Gyulama about you know, the existence of the Buddha nature are not kind of obviously not really contradictory. You know, they are two sides of two ways of looking at the same thing, and complement each other. But I mean, I think, you know, the Prajnaparamita as a whole is certainly, although it's kind of very loosely classified as being all about emptiness, it's not really, is it? It goes far further than that. It has a huge range of different topics and ways of understanding that really the Abhisamalankara in particular brought out. because here you know you have, if you like, the original sort of Prajnaparamita interpretations of Nagarjuna, very much going along Madhyamika lines about how there is no no sort of definitive existence for anything really. But Asanga really, in a way, as the founder of the sort of vast tradition, luckily, I think, gave us a much wider perspective, a much vaster perspective on Nagarjuna's deep insights, if you like, and brought in a whole range of practices and approaches and stages and all the rest of it that you wouldn't really find and would be a little bit unapproachable if you studied entirely from the sort of Nagarjuna viewpoint, isn't it? And I'm very interested because I've been delving deeply into, well, deeply, I think it would take a lifetime to do that, but I've been looking more than I ever had before into the Prajnaparamita texts recently because I've been editing a translation of the Nitri, the Prajnaparamita in 25,000 lines, which we are going to be publishing in 84,000 in probably take a, quite a few more months, but it's kind of approaching readiness. And really the range of topics and so forth that one could find in the long Prajnaparamita sutras, let alone of course the whole range of Prajnaparamita literature is extraordinary. So I think to sort of step back and look at them schematically is very interesting, but in down at the down at the level of at the more granular level of the detail of what they're all about is gives a very different picture. And really the Abhisamalankara Alankara in particular pointed to that, didn't it? It pointed to the sort of implicit teachings in the Prajnaparamita about the different stages, the different paths, the different ways that they can be seen, and that I think gives a very different perspective.
Well, that's wonderful, and I think you are such a great advocate and exponent of what MIPHAM would have liked to convey regarding Buddha nature, trying to not trying to actually synergizing the second and the third turning of the wheel, sort of coalescing the empty and luminous nature of the mind. This is really very clear and convincing, but a lot of the other scholars do the opposite, no? Especially scholars in Sakya and Gelug traditions, instead of seeing something more sort of substantive and finding something in the Prajnaparamita, Perfection of Wisdom Sutras about luminosity of Buddha nature, they would instead interpret the third turning, or even this text, the ultimate continuum, and understand Gotra as simply emptiness. So,
Yes, well,
anyway,
yeah.
please go ahead. Sorry.
I was going to say we had a very interesting teaching a few weeks ago from Kempo Pema Sherab, who was telling us, and again, I don't remember, I didn't really even take in the full details, but he was suggesting that people again sort of so strongly dedicated to the views of their own lineage. Sometimes he was telling us about a copy of the I don't even know which Prajnaparamita Sutra, maybe the Nitri, that belonged to the library in Zamtang, which were, they sort of kept as evidence, if you like, of skullduggery, because there was a manuscript where somebody at some point in history, and I have no idea who's responsible or when it happened, had actually crossed out a reference to luminosity and substituted, Tongpo Nyi. So, there was a sort of feeling feeling that the texts ought to be, they ought to say something that they didn't actually say, you know what I mean? So I am all for a sort of global synthetic view of what the teachings are about and how, you know, they're not, not, of course, the whole idea of distinguishing between what's definitive and what's provisional is an extremely important approach. You know, we'd be lost without having those perspectives. But if you divide it into compartments that are too completely watertight, you know, and really what some people seem to be saying is that if there's a provisional teaching, you don't even need to take any notice of it. You know what I mean? And of course, the idea of a provisional teaching is that it's something that's actually really helpful and is important for somebody to take really seriously at some stage on their path. And if we sort of dismiss anything that's provisional as sort of lightweight and inconsequential, then that's kind of missing the point. And maybe there isn't quite such a hard and fast line that you can always draw between provisional and definitive. After all, if the real nature of everything is so inexpressible and ineffable and impossible to grasp intellectually, then how can we really talk about any teaching being definitive? You know what I mean? Everything is provisional, surely. So it would be nice to, you know, in a way, sort of dissolve some of those watertight compartments. But I was very inspired by, you know, the approach of my teachers, and I'm particularly thinking of Dzogchen Rinpoche, who, whenever he gave a teaching on a whatever topic it was, he would weave in all sorts of notions and ideas and quotes from really all of the teachings at all levels, you know, all the vehicles and all of the traditions, and the sort of somehow see it all as a kind of network of perspectives that all had their value. And that seems to me to be, you know, a very positive approach to Buddhist literature as a whole, isn't it?
Yeah, I think this inclusive approach that we find particularly among the Rime masters, I think is so important. And when you shared this story from Kenpo Pema Sherab about somebody changing the words of the Prajnaparamita Sutras, I as a young monk was also told about a certain Lama, I will name the Lama, editing the Lhasa Kanjur and sort of inserting phrases to align the reading of the Kanjur with the interpretation of his particular school. But yeah, I think that kind of risk is faced also by modern translators. You know, as we translate into a different language, as we discussed earlier, if we choose a specific term like potential for Gotra, it already sort of creates that bias that the person who will read the text will obviously get that particular understanding and not a very inclusive one. So it's very important, I think, for translators to remain as neutral and as inclusive as possible. We have more or less run out of time. There's so much to talk about. Let me see if there are questions, if Marcus can help us, if there are questions on Facebook or on Zoom from the audience.
There's one question coming in. If people want to ask some more, please put it in the Q&A function on Zoom, or send it in the chat, or use Facebook if you're live. One person has asked, do you consider that there is any difference between Buddha nature and Tlenchik Kepe Yeshe? And or how would you describe the relationship? Tlenchik Kepe Yeshe.
Yes, well, this is the one, you know, one of those sort of tricky questions that I wouldn't really know how to start answering. But of course, you know, Buddha nature is covers a variety of stages really. And if, you know, in the classical explanations, Buddha nature refers to the state of Buddhahood as it's present in a sentient being who still has obscurations. So in a sense, Lenchi Kyepe Yeshe refers to the same thing in the sense of it being innate. I'm actually not really sure what the different contexts in which Lenchi Kyepe Yeshe is used as a term. You know, I think it's quite a variety of them. So it wouldn't be, you know, it wouldn't be fair to sort of say, well, yes, they mean exactly the same thing. I think it's a question of context. But of course, in the end, they're referring to the same, you know, the fact that this is really something that is our nature and has always been our nature, and therefore, what we're trying to do is to uncover it, to discover it, and that's what the path is really all about.
Thank you. Let's see, there's another question here coming in. Oh,
well, if
Karma, you seem to be either muted or we're not hearing you.
Sorry. So if I can add something to that, I was wondering, and I want your take on this as well. I was wondering if Lenchi Kyepe Yeshe is a term that is used to refer to Buddha nature, of course, but used more predominantly in the tantric texts, and perhaps even more in the new tantric texts, the tantric texts of the new translations, the new schools. And Buddha nature, of course, is more sort of exoteric sutra term. So Buddha nature certainly can cover both the potential as well as the full-blown Buddhahood in us, whereas Lenchi Kyepe Yeshe already sort of assumes that we're talking about a latent Buddhahood, a full-blown Buddha in us. Would you say that is fair?
Yes, I think so. I mean, in a way, so is Buddha nature. But I mean, of course, this is what makes the whole Buddha nature teachings and the Gulama in particular as so important and has such a strong impact on many people, particularly if they're practitioners, because it gives us that bridge between, you know, the sort of sutra teachings that are causal and how you have to sort of accumulate all the causes and gradually, you know, gather the conditions and everything for awakening. Whereas Buddha nature gives you the inkling, at least, which is the sort of root of tantra practice, that you can, that there is a result that is already present, that you could in some sense imagine, at least, you know, by visualizing and deity practice and by working on through yoga practices and so forth. And you know, that's incredibly inspiring, I think, and gives us a sort of sound theoretical basis with a lot of very convincing arguments that support, you know, any kind of tantric practice, as well as, of course, the basic Mahayana practice too.
And this term, Lenchi Kyepe Yeshe, often comes with the sort of the preceding qualifier, nyukma, innate. So Mipham deals with the nyukma Lenchi Kyepe Yeshe, or nyuksem, in his trilogy on innate mind. You must have looked at those as well. In fact, I was wondering, though, even the commentary on Dulama is not something Mipham composed sort of seriously in his lifetime, but was compiled by his students. And the Nyuksem, the trilogy on the innate mind, they are also sort of compilations of his students. When you look at them, do you find any issues? Do you think all the ideas can be attributed to Mipham himself?
No, I mean, I think this, you know, this is often said about Mipham's commentary, and it's true in a sense that it existed in the form of, in his lifetime, in the form of notes that he made, and he gave many teachings on it, but was really only put together posthumously, you know, by Kempo Kumpel and by Shechen Gelsap's insistence. But Mipham gave quite a lot of very clear indications of how he would approach the ulama. And in fact, I was very interested when I first started trying to translate it, because I realized how very close it was to Khongtrul Rinpoche's, Jamgon Khongtrul's commentary. And the reason is that Mipham based himself very much on Dolpopa's commentary, but he added little bits from Rongtenpa. And so it makes it a very balanced, you know, I mean, we say Dolpopa, of course, you think of sort of extreme Shentong views, but actually Dolpopa's Gyulama commentary is very reasonable. It's very sort of, it's very, yes, moderate, I would say, from a Shentong Rantong point of view. And Rongtenpa, of course, was a Rangtongpa. So his comments, again, are very sort of reasonable and moderate. And combining the two gives you an even more sort of balanced picture. So I think Mipham's commentary is, and it used the structure that Mipham had recommended, which was Patrul Rinpoche's subject, which again was pretty much based on Dolpopa's commentary. So you have this sort of combination of views and aspects that are not very elaborate, but present a very clear picture of the meaning of the text without going into lots of sort of details of, you know, and in a way it ends up very simple. And I think that that's one of its great qualities.
I think there are quite a number of questions. So Marcus,
yes, there's a lot coming in. On that, someone has asked, I heard that Mipham considers the second and third turning as definitive when taken together, but considers them as provisional when taken separately. Can you comment on that?
Well, I can't, I don't actually know whether he said that or not, so I can't say whether it's true or not. Probably Kamala would know better than I do, but I think I'm not sure that makes complete sense. I think that really what Mipham's saying, of course, is that if they are both definitive, then they both have something vital to say. And perhaps what, if he did make such a statement, it would be to say that, you know, you can't sort of just talk about the emptiness aspect and completely leave out the other. About, you know, about appearance and luminosity and all the rest, and you can't talk just about luminosity and completely leave out the emptiness aspect. So from that point of view, to sort of just take one without the other would be incomplete, and if by incomplete you also mean provisional, then that would make sense.
On another topic, we have a question about luminosity. Could you discuss luminosity in relation to the kayas and emptiness and the Dharmata self-revealing through luminosity? I'm not sure quite what that meant, but I think you get the idea.
Well, yes, I'm not good at talking about luminosity, I must say. but, you know, I think... I put it like this. I've never quite liked the term. You know, luminosity to me was always something that I had on when I was a kid. I had watches that glowed in the dark. You know what I mean? And when I see this term luminous, I always think of something that glows in the dark, which I suppose is not bad for Buddha nature. You know, something that shines in the... in the light, in the darkness of ignorance sort of thing. But I think, you know, luminosity, clarity, the idea that there is something to be shown, there's something to be illuminated, or something to be defined, rather than, you know, sort of blank emptiness. You know, people very easily get the idea that everything dissolves into emptiness and all of that, that we're in a sort of vacuum, you know, where there isn't, where it's just sort of darkness or real sort of void space, you know, where there's nothing. But I think, you know, all the teachings about luminosity are really about how emptiness leaves the space for things to happen and for things to appear. And then, you know, what if you have all of the space that's been created by letting go of, you know, concepts and sort of habitual patterns of perception and all the rest of it, then what, you know, what is there? What does appear? And I think that that's the sort of essential question, really, that the teachings bring out. And I think that perhaps that's the part in particular that the Madhyamaka teachings tend to not say much about, not explain much about. And really what the Gyulama is talking about is that we, you know, is that Buddhahood is not an absence of everything. It's actually has qualities. And those qualities, the qualities of Buddhahood that appear, are very, very hard to understand, in a sense. Of course, they include, you know, the kayas, they include the different levels of manifestation that might be perceived according to how free of obscurations one can become. But they include all sorts of extraordinary things, you know, like the 32 major marks and the 80 signs and, you know, these 18 distinct qualities and all the rest of it, which are, I think, a very important topic in the Gyulama, of course, in other texts too. But they, you know, I think the way that the Gyulama talks about how it's possible that something which is uncompounded still has qualities, it still has, when awakening is attained, there are kind of consequences that result in the appearance and manifestation of the qualities. That is something quite extraordinary and certainly deserves a lot of thought, and is the sort of background for an awful lot of practice.
Yeah, I was fortuitously actually in the past few days looking at how the different sutras and tantras define pravaswara or luminosity, clear light that we translate as. And quite few texts, especially from the Perfection of Wisdom sutras, you find the term pravaswara or luminosity being defined as one that is free from afflictions. So the focus is so much on the nature of mind or whatever, being free from the obscurations and afflictions in its true nature. And I also found some references directly to luminosity being explained as in reference to the qualities of the Buddha being present in the nature of the mind, and some referring to kind of state of emptiness or being free from all elaborations and conceptual constructions. There are a few also directly linking to almost physical light or sort of radiance and some kind of sort of brightness. So I think different sutras and tantras, and then obviously the commentaries all sort of vary on their definition of luminosity or pravaswara. And in many cases, we do find it linked to the kayas, the enlightened bodies of the Buddhas, and also emptiness. So that's what I want to chip in.
Indeed, yes, thank you. Thank you. Yes, I mean, I think it's fascinating, the whole idea of what, you know, what would we see? What would we see if we had an entirely sort of unobscured perception? And again, from a lot of the basic Mahayana teachings, there's not a lot of indications, but they are there, I think. And especially, you know, as you come up into the sort of higher levels of Tantra, it seems to explain more and more, you know, why things might appear as they are said to do, rather than, you know, what appears to us now. So that is a, you know, huge topic about which I am certainly not an expert.
So there are a few more questions. We probably have time for a couple more.
Is it okay, John, if we run a bit longer, or should we wrap it up?
It's fine for me. No, I've absolutely no problem.
Well, let's go until 10:20 my time.
No, I don't want to sort of obliterate anybody's questions, but one of the things I had wanted to talk about a bit more, and we didn't get to it, but is this very fascinating legends of how Asanga discovered how he was taught these five texts by Maitreya. And, you know, I just wanted to put it out there. Of course, we know that this is not a, this is not what the Chinese tradition sees as, you know, they have a different set of the five teachings of Maitreya, which don't include the Gyulama, which the Chinese believed was written, composed by somebody called Saramati, who was perhaps lived even a little bit before Asanga, but is a very shadowy figure. We don't have too many details. There's one other text that's said to have been written by him. But these very interesting and very touching legends of how Asanga, as a young student monk in up in Afghanistan, basically, in Peshawar, was sort of found it very easy to understand all of the Mahayana sutras and teachings that were available, except the Prajnaparamita, and therefore he sought guidance. And very, very interestingly, you know, it looks as if these legends describe him having some sort of an empowerment, where his flower fell on Maitreya as his kind of guiding deity, which is, again, you know, according to what we would see from an academic point of view, that would be a little bit anachronistic, but why not? You know, there's, I think we should keep a very open mind about it. But that's what led him, of course, to undergo his many years of a retreat down in the plains in India, or in this site, which is said to be perhaps this Kukutapada mountain somewhere near Bodh Gaya. And it's a fascinating story with an awful lot of detail, and even some, you know, verses that what he was said to have said at different points. And we don't know where all that comes from. You know, it's presumably some sort of an oral tradition that accompanied one of the five texts when they were brought to Tibet. But, you know, the three texts that were brought in the early period and the two texts that were brought in the later period, we can't really tell which ones these legends came with. I suppose the Abhisamma Alankara is the sort of more likely of the five. But I find this legend and its details extraordinarily interesting and moving. And again, it sort of highlights the whole, it starts with the time of Asanga's mother, when she could see that the teachings, particularly the Mahayana teachings, seemed to be in danger of disappearing. This was, of course, when they had, in some sense, only just begun. And she felt that it was really necessary for her to do something, and the best thing that she could think of doing was to, you know, bring up sons who would be really great scholars. And, of course, that's exactly what she did. But, you know, I would be really interested if anybody ever finds evidence of where they came from, these legends. As far as we know, they were first written down in some of the early Tibetan histories. I couldn't find earlier traces than in these two histories written by one of them written by Kepa Deyu, which were only came to light, you know, 20-30 years ago, perhaps. I think 13th century. So before that, we don't have any trace of these stories. of course, you know, rather cynical academics might say, well, they were just, you know, invented by somebody. They're just stories. But bearing in mind, you know, how reluctant Buddhists are to create anything new, you know, there's this very strong sense of transmission and lineage, and you don't add things. You know, you transmit what you receive. I would be a little bit surprised if anybody really sat down and sort of wrote those stories or invented them. Of course, they can grow organically and expand. But anyway, I just want to say how fascinating I find them, and how meaningful they seem to be in many ways. You know, Asanga's sort of quest as a metaphor for people really wanting to find out what something means and being determined to do so. And of course, Asanga had these incredible difficulties. Not really, we could all sympathize with that. I spent myself years in retreat, and it's kind of frustrating. You hope you have this romantic idea that you're going to really come out completely transformed and different, and of course it takes a bit more than that. You know, it takes a long time, it takes a lot of effort and a lot of other ingredients, and so one can really sympathize with Asanga's difficulties, and then the idea that in the end, you know, Maitreya was with him all the time. It's a sort of wonderful metaphor for Buddha nature, you know, but his obscurations were too dense for him to perceive Maitreya. There's this wonderful story I heard in one of the oral versions of that account. I don't think it's in any of the written versions, where Maitreya even shows him his zen, you know, his robe that he was wearing rather close to Asanga, when Asanga would spit, you know, the Maitreya would sort of catch it on his robe, and he showed him the stains, you know what I mean? So I think that narrative is a wonderful kind of background to the text itself, and it's you know what it says sort of doctrinally, and not to be ignored.
Yeah, I also really like this story, the legend behind the five works of Maitreya. And I suppose in the spiritual world there's so much we don't know, so it would be very wrong to dismiss anything as historical or untrue. But one of the things that is also very prominently associated with this legend is the message of compassion in it. The story is told over and over again to show how important compassion is in on your path to enlightenment. So Asanga only seeing Maitreya after showing that intense compassion, and not really getting sight of Maitreya even after so many years of worshiping Maitreya. So yes, it's a very beautiful moral of the story.
Absolutely, yes, that's a really crucial element in it. Yeah, So sorry, yes, I just wanted to put that in, despite, I'm sure people have some
No, thank you. That's a very beautiful part of the whole story of this text and Maitreya works. Marcus, shall we take a couple more questions as John doesn't want to?
10:20, then it might be quite late for you, but we could perhaps take a final question. There's a question about practice, so that would be good to follow up there. Someone's mentioning how the different terms for Buddha nature actually inspire them in different ways, like that Buddha potential helps one to make effort, but Buddha nature really inspires this person to go on, gives them that faith perhaps. And so maybe as a way for a final question, I could just ask you about your own experience with that, with practice and with Buddha nature, and what inspires you. Maybe you could share with us a little bit about how Buddha nature teachings have affected you.
Well, yes, I must say, I think I said this already, but I personally, coming across the Buddha nature teachings, I was extremely encouraged and inspired. You know, it, and the Gyulama in particular, it has this wonderful sort of what could you say? It has this sort of global view of what's going on. You know what I mean? Here we are, we sentient beings, and we're only a small part of the story, in a sense. You know, there are the three jewels, and awakening is our sort of goal. It's our sort of potential, and because of the existence of the three jewels, that can be unlocked. You know, we can start removing our obscurations, and there's wonderful passages that explain the signs of there being Buddha nature. You know, the very fact that we somehow yearn for happiness and want not to suffer. You know what I mean? We're really not just sort of inanimate creatures. Well, inanimate creatures is obviously a sort of bit of a paradox, but you know what I mean? We're not oblivious to the existence of something better, and we're searching for it in ways that are not always very successful. And you know, the Buddha nature teachings kind of show us how the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha can really lead us in the right direction. But that fundamentally, you know, it's already there, and we only need to look in the right place, or we only need to start, you know, clearing away the weeds, as it were, to discover what we already have. And you know, it's very good at removing the sort of inferiority complex that it's very easy to have as a Buddhist practitioner. You know, we are ignorant, sentient beings, you know, blinded by stupidity, anger, attachment, and all the rest of it. You know, it gets laid on quite thick what a miserable state we're in, you know, and bound to suffer in samsara and accumulating karma and all the rest of it. And it's a very sort of encouraging and refreshing notion that, you know, even if we have a way to go, you know, that somehow it's possible, it's really possible, almost in a sense inevitable. You know, it's a question of time, because that really is our true nature. And then in the same way that, you know, these teachings, that there are no real differences between the awakened Buddhas and obscured sentient beings, except for that little bit of, you know, almost non-existent obscuration, is again incredibly encouraging. You know, it makes what separates us from awakening look quite flimsy. And you know, it looks as if it's something that's quite workable, something that we can actually do. And then again, as I mentioned already, this whole way that the Buddha nature teachings gives us a bridge to tantra practice, and makes it not just a sort of fantasy. You know, you can visualize yourself as some sort of an enlightened deity, and all that means, and the idea that when you're doing that, you really are contacting something that is there already, something that is innate in you, and that is just waiting there to be discovered, and that you can, by beginning to imagine it, you can actually kind of get to it and access it, and begin to allow it to manifest. And I found that an interesting, but inspiring idea. And to me, it made a huge difference in my practice. And many people say the same. You know, if you take the teaching seriously and really study them and find out what they mean, it's an incredibly positive message. And makes sense of so many other parts of the teaching.
So, Nivey, we started with you explaining how there was a big sort of cultural gap, and you have been moving from one to the other. It's exactly this kind of situation where, isn't it, you have a cultural or personal background with low self-esteem or self-hatred or, you know, even ideas like original sin and so forth. And then you move on to a new refreshing view of the life with being innately good, full of opportunities, possibilities. And in fact, that also helps address the two questions that we didn't manage to address about, you know, being born in the lineage or the family of the Buddhas. I think we are already in the family. We just have to make that manifest. And when one starts the path of a bodhisattva, you sort of come to the recognition that your true family is the family of the enlightened ones, or that even nature allows for so much development and creativity and production, which is one aspect that somebody wanted to address. Anyway, now this is the kind of message we want to also spread across the world, this sort of positive thinking about one's true sort of nature. How can we amplify this kind of message to the wider audience beyond the Dharma centers and the academic circles? Can you give us some advice? Of course, we have now the website where we can find a great deal of materials for beginners and for intermediate learners and very advanced learners and practitioners. But how can we reach a broader audience?
Yes, well, that's a fascinating question, and it's a very, I think it's a very important one. And we've been thinking about this a lot in 84,000. You know, we making huge efforts, and sponsors are spending, you know, very considerable sums on helping us to translate all of the Buddha's words and the incredible texts and making them available. And I think it takes quite a long time for people to really notice, you know, and to become aware that that material is there, and again, to really use it, not just sort of look at it and say, yeah, okay, you know, next click, you know, go somewhere else. It's very, we're all so dispersed, and it's very difficult, isn't it? But I think, I think one thing is to, there are so many people who are interested in Buddhism, mindfulness, meditation, yoga, you know, in the sense of a sort of bit of a, you know, give some kind of relief or some kind of a brief moment of, you know, getting away from the stresses and strains, or some way of relieving, you know, the pressures of life. It would be really nice to get people to see that it goes a lot further than that. You know what I mean? It's such a pity, and I think people who sort of take up Buddhism like a sort of hobby, you know, like you might, or meditation, like sort of woodworking or collecting stamps, you know what I mean? It's so much more, it would be so nice to find ways of making it more obvious to people how important it was, and how essential, you know, the meaning of the teaching is. But it's very hard, isn't it? It's very hard to get that across. And I think, you know, you can't go around sort of preaching. I think that's one of the wonderful things, again, that impressed me about the Dharma when I first met Buddhist teachers, was that actually nobody was forcing me. Nobody was saying, you know, you must come, you must do this, you must do that, you must believe this, you must believe that. And that makes you more interested in a way. So I think it takes time, and we have to sort of try to be visible and try to find ways of inspiring people. But in, I want to tell a wonderful story. You probably, many of you heard of Nyosho Ken Rinpoche, Nyosho Kenpo, who is a wonderful Kenpo teacher, and I'm sure you know him well, Kama, who spent many years here too, and was with us some of the time when we were in retreat. And he used to like going to the seaside, And he went several times in on the west coast of Brittany and the coast near here, which is a couple of hours away. These huge beaches, and he would see people lying on the beach, you know, on the sun, in the sun. And several times he said he wanted to hire a kind of loudspeaker van and go around teaching people and saying, you know, don't just lie there in the sun. You know, you have, if you have the leisure and the time, it's wonderful, and you must use it for something meaningful, you know what I mean? And to try to explain, you know, the nature of mind and things to people. But of course, he knew that that wouldn't work. But he said how frustrating it is, you know, to see people with all this time and leisure, and the best thing that they can find to do with it is to lie with not very many clothes on, sometimes none at all, on a beach. Mm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
He was sort of amused and frustrated, and really wanted to try and do something. And of course, I don't think he ever did manage to hire a loudspeaker van, and even if he had,
naked on the beach sounds like an ideal situation to practice dzogchen and even enhance one's pleasure in this. So with that, I think we should conclude the session. John, thank you very, very much for coming to talk to us. And I hope we'll come back again, and we hope.
Yes, well, I'm sorry to have given such a sort of disjointed, chaotic, just a few random thoughts. That's why I said I thought this would be sort of a dilettante's rambling, because that's what it is. But anyway, just to give a taste and to, you know, make contact. And I can't contribute in the same way that some of your wonderful previous guests have been able to, you know, reeling off incredible details about, you know, what each commentator had in terms of, you know, exact views about the different aspects of Buddha nature. That's not really my thing, but I certainly have been very, very inspired by the teachings, and hope to continue studying them for the rest of my life and trying to make them available to people. And in particular, I do hope to get this commentary published in the next year or two, let's say.
So thank you. Thank you. In fact, we spend even longer time with you than most others, because you have this very unique, different approach of a very thoughtful, contemplative approach to the topic. So thank you very much for that. Thank you, audience, wherever you are, and have a wonderful weekend. Wish you the best with the rest of the Saga Dawa that we are observing here in the MLS. So thank you. Good night.
Okay.
Thank you, Marcus.
Thank you all.
Thank you, John.